The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us in the studio today for Campus Voices, we have two professors from the University of Delaware's Geography Department sitting to my left. And you're right, as you look at the radio, we have Lindsay Naylor. And to my right, your left, we have Paul Jackson. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're glad to be here.
So what the heck is geography besides maps, and how does it relate to Earth Month?
Oh, it's a great question. I love it when people ask about geography, because geographers study the surface of the Earth. We're interested in why things are the way they are because of where they are.
And I think also because, you know, Earth Day is about environments, we should think about all the different environments that are on the planet. And things like the urban cities, they're also environments as well. Mm-hmm. So that's another way to think about environmentalism. Is there's lots of different places that there are around the world.
And geography is quite literally earth writing. It's what it means. And so it's an interesting way to look at how humans have sort of written themselves into the landscape, both through cities and other environmental things, like agriculture, for example, as well.
And we always have to say that we're not geologists, as in we don't really study rocks.
No.
So it's always good to know.
One of the things when we met last week we were talking about is Rachel Carson's Silent Spring is a good starting place of understanding geography and the environmental movement.
Yeah, and especially environmental geography, or where geography and environmentalism comes together. And I always like to start with Rachel Carson because she was talking about birds and how that might pesticides might affect birds and birds being silenced. But also she was a scientist, a woman scientist, who her expertise was looked down upon. But also she had cancer at that time. And so these environmental toxins in the environment sometimes have very personal sort of consequences. And I think she's a great example of that.
I agree.
The two of you come at geography and the environment from different points of view. Lindsay, I think you do more with agricultural kinds of things. And Paul, you do, as you already mentioned, things that have more to do with urban kinds of situations.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a difference in the way that we sort of use a different lens for thinking about humans and how they interact with their environment and really how the environment impacts humans. I like to use agriculture and food as a lens because the allocation and distribution of agricultural resources and food is very uneven. And as geographers, are really interested in how things are unevenly allocated across particular places and at different scales. So global production and distribution of agricultural goods is different, and we can look at it at a national scale as well. We can look at the scale of the city. We can look at the scale of the household, how people experience different sort of agricultural resources or food resources, and we can see that things are pretty uneven. There are some people who are doing better than others, and that's one of the ways that I like to look at things.
And I think part of, especially in related to Earth Day, I think part of as an urban geographer and looking at urban environmental issues, when we think of environmentalism, we think more of like, you know, national parks, Yosemite, beautiful places far away from humans. But that is just one environment and it's part of many. And if you think of cities, there are also ecological issues. You have things like where does our water come from? Things like rats in the city, also an ecology. And so it brings up different questions around also where do, say, the trash from cities go? And whose backyard is that going to be placed in? So these are all environmental issues that people don't always think about when they think of Earth Day. They usually think of trees or the Arctic, which are very important, but also just one part of geography.
That's a good point. We don't all live in a national park. We all live in either urban, suburban, or rural farming kinds of environments. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things have you been studying lately, Lindsay?
Well, I'm doing a lot of different work. My research is, kind of all over the map. Oh, gosh, geography puns, be aware. But actually, as they relate to Earth Month, one of the things I'm excited to be talking about with my students who I'm working with on food geographies right now is the issue of food waste, which really gets back and sort of ties things into all of these different communities that Paul is describing. But it's also become really a hot topic. In fact, just today it was announced that Starbucks has decided to reduce its food waste stream by donating all of the food that's left over at the end of the day to different groups and for its 7,000 stores or outlets around the United States. And so it's partnering with groups to bring food to people. And I think that this is because food waste is something that has really received a lot of public sort of attention in the last 6 months. And because 40%, up to 40% of the food in the United States ends up in the landfill. It doesn't either make it to people's plates or it is, you know, rotted on its way to the grocery store, or it rots in our refrigerators, or we throw it away because, oh, it says that it expired. And so there's a lot of discussion around, well, how can we divert these streams? Maybe instead of going to the landfill, we can consider things such as composting, which would be really exciting. And I know there are a number of students in my class who would love to see a composting program at the University of Delaware because they're throwing away a lot of their food scraps. Maybe they don't have dogs that they can feed them to under the table. But composting is one way of diverting waste from the stream. But also there's conversations around changing things or our attitudes towards expiration dates, because those aren't really regulated for a lot of foods. They are things that are coming strictly from the manufacturer and are more often based on manufacturers' desire for people to consume things at the highest quality that they perceive their product to be at. So people are throwing things away that might be perfectly good, but are, you know, based in this formula that's coming from a manufacturer. And so there's a lot of different ways that we can think about this, but there's a substantial amount, you know, billions of tons of food that are going into the landfill. And that touches on so many things about how we are interacting with our environment, from the fuel that it takes to transport it, to the energy it takes to grow food, to a whole host of other things that are in some ways damaging to the environment, that in essence we're kind of wasting that effort and that energy and you know, displacing it into these other, to create other problems.
One of the ways that I think that food waste and the food production system impacts Paul's area is if you look at, for example, what's happened in Beijing, China, with they've started doing so many different feedlot kinds of things that the environment's gone, and now in addition to all the regular smog pollutants, you've got lots of dust coming into the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fecal dust.
Yeah, and so that's part of what I'm interested in, is how our environments affect our bodies, like our health. And so part of what I do is looking at urban health. And so we should look at all the different ways, like dust in China, or something much more local in the United States, around recent controversies in Flint, Michigan, around lead levels. And so lead has always been an urban environmental issue. And in the past, it was more about lead paint and children eating lead paint. But we can see how human choices about in Flint, Michigan, like where should we get our water from, affect children and children's development. And this is, you know, a lot of time we talk about humans impacting the environment or climate change, but we can even see that on like a local municipal board. I would say, like, where what's the best water, and should we make those choices for health reasons? Should we make those choices for economic reasons? Should we make those choices for environmental reasons? And that's where, you know, policy and politics are really important to understand a lot of these environmental issues.
Now, that's not a new issue. It goes back to at least as far back as the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the Roman Empire, part of building their civilization was getting water, and you can still see the traces to this moment. And so water issues, especially in geography, is a issue that keeps coming up. And now, say in California with the drought crisis, there's a choice. Should the water go to lawns in suburbia, or should it go to the agricultural communities and the strawberry farms, or should it go to the people? These are choices that we sort of all have to make together.
Lindsay and I share something in common, having mothers in Arizona.
We do.
So we see that up close and personal when we go visit.
Yeah, absolutely. And One of the things that is interesting is that there's a corporate culture around tourism and vacationing and golf, and so we see these lush landscapes in the middle of the desert. But on a consumer level, too, we're starting to see some people in these arid areas backing away from that sort of American ideal of the lawn, and there's a lot of xeriscaping happening, which is drought-tolerant plants and maybe rock and different things instead of a lawn and sort of tapping into those water resources on a personal level in such a highly consumptive way. So there's a contrast on that landscape, and a number of contrasts, rather, on that landscape.
I think it's nuts every time I go out there and I see people with these lush lawns or those golf courses in Scottsdale.
Yeah. I mean, but that's another really interesting conversation we can have around scale, too, though, because a lot of people are really concerned about what they can do, right? Students are asking me, hey, is it okay for me to have almond milk while there's a drought in California, you know, because almonds grow in California. That's where they are coming from. And should I be drinking a different dairy substitute, or do I even need to substitute dairy? And there's all these questions that compound about what people can do on a personal scale. And one of the things that I find really interesting is that if we think about our choice, that's one thing. And it's important, you know, not just to vote necessarily with your fork or your dollar, but with your vote, right? Naomi Starkman of Civil Eats asked that question about millennials in a recent report. You know, are millennials interested in just what they're doing, or are they going to also participate as citizens of the United States? And I find that to be a really intriguing question, because a lot of decisions are made for us at a corporate level. You know, water systems are being dictated not so much by our governments, but by corporations. And there are other sort of things that are happening on the landscape that we have a different influence over.
I just think of the fights over the water from the Colorado River.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Paul said, who's going to use this water?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you look again, putting on my urban geographer hat, if you look at the even the creation of Los Angeles, it was tied to taking a lot of that water and sort of producing these cities. And if the water goes away, so do the people. And so these you can never take the environment and the people out of the equation. They come together. And that's part of, I think, was one of the main purposes of Earth Day, is to bring in the environmental question to a sort of national audience in the United States.
We're talking with Paul Jackson and Lindsay Naylor from the University of Delaware's Department of Geography. And as you can hear, geography is much more than drawing pretty maps. I mean, these guys are studying why things are the way they are, including where these things are happening. Talk with me about the Philadelphia sugar tax.
Oh, goodness. You start.
Okay. Well, it now Philadelphia is taking a page from New York City to be taxing sweetness, taxing sugar, taxing soft drinks. And it is part of thinking about urban policy to, you know, thinking about how we live and what we eat and what we choose to eat. And I have, you know, complicated feelings about it. It's related to, I think, a lot of discussions about environmentalism taking on a sort of moral tone, like you should do this, like you should have this type of lawn. And I don't know if it's the correct way to get people involved in environmental politics or healthy eating. Right. I don't know, Lindsay, if you have some thoughts on that.
I have a lot of thoughts on that, which is why I suggested you start so that I can collect them, because, again,
yep. We only have 16 minutes left, Lindsay.
Well, we have a long history of the government regulating what we eat and how we should engage with food. This is something I talk about with my students, that since the 1950s, we've had food guidelines, and they're sort of these loosely designed goals for people to meet that are heavily influenced by corporate lobbies. And so the sugar tax in Philadelphia is an extension of that to some degree. Like, hey, you might be thinking about that. You know, it's a sin tax, though. And those are things that people have traditionally not been very excited about, but that history demonstrates has had some success. If you look at how we regulate, for example, tobacco products in the United States. Removing advertising from schools, taxing tobacco products, making it so you couldn't advertise on television with children's programs or use, you know, fluffy bunnies smoking cigarettes to entice a different audience. And that's been largely successful in terms of keeping a younger population from maybe starting smoking, some reports say.
I think it's interesting to me hearing the political ads opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't, they just take a point of view of, we don't want to have to pay more for the drinks our family consumes.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the on a policy level, what they're trying to do is deal with a crisis, the obesity crisis. And so part of that, thinking about obesity as in what we consume is one question, but lots of other researchers have thought that maybe it's not what we consume, but the environments that we live in. So perhaps it's getting people more active, out of their cars. It's changing how we move through the world. And that might be bike lanes. That might be more recreational programs. Might deal with the obesity crisis and have other benefits rather than just focusing on caloric intake. Mm-hmm. That's just one specific aspect of a sort of environment-human relationship.
Yeah, and the calories in, calories out sort of paradigm has received a lot of criticism, especially from geographers. And it really is about how we're interacting with our spaces and how things are set up. You know, for example, nutritionist at NYU, Marian Nessel, talks about grocery stores are set up in a way to have us, you know, wandering through aisles and aisles of processed foods, the very things that we're encouraged not to eat very much of. So how even the grocery store is set up is an environment that influences our bodies. And that's something to take into account. But a lot of the campaigns about personal choice, I think, are very interesting, especially because mostly they're being supported by the very companies that stand to lose a market share if their product is taxed. And there's some great work being done on the politics of sort of processed food companies, especially the soda companies. That has come out and sort of talks about these efforts to bring identity and personal freedom to part of the discussion.
It's interesting to me that there are so many different ways of looking at this kind of issue. Mm-hmm. We've got professors in nutrition looking at it. We've got professors in the College of Education, Human and Development, looking at it strictly from a policy point of view. And then we got you guys looking at it from a point of view that also brings in the geography.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of geography has always been an interdisciplinary discipline in many ways. We have climatologists and we have people who study culture. And so part of...
There's more, too.
it's sort of two poles. But I think what's important is that what geography is good for is bringing in all these different perspectives together to dealing with specific problems and helping us rethink those problems.
In the studio with us is a geography major, Nate Phillips, who's a member of the class of 2017.
Yep, mm-hmm. That's right.
And one of the things you specialize in or are specializing in is the use of geographic information systems, GIS.
Yep. So basically GIS is using... it's a software suite called ArcGIS. It's basically spatial statistics. Mm-hmm. So it's seeing quantities of where things are.
So like looking for example, in the what we'd be talking about, seeing the distribution of soda sales depending on where in the city.
Right. So you would create like heat maps of like obesity and income, and you see where people are consuming things, income levels.
And it's a way to tell a story, I think, about data, and it's increasingly, well, it's the fastest growing career segment of geography. So get those GIS skills. Like, that is, a lot of people are getting jobs and they're getting paid very well to have these GIS skills. So I encourage people to take GIS. But it's also something that ArcGIS is one sort of program that's being used, but it's increasingly becoming open source. And so there are open source varieties. And there are a lot of different ways that people are volunteering their time through disaster mapping. For example, after the Nepal earthquake, the group Mappers Without Borders, or Humanitarian Mapping Society, did a whole suite of maps to help assist with the impact of the earthquake. So it's something that's being used in a variety of different ways. Yes, we can tell stories about food deserts. Yes, we can talk about how urban space has changed over time. We can do lots of different things with maps, and it's really very exciting.
One of the most fun things that we talked about last week, or I should say one of the cutest things we talked about
dear.
Last week, was Lindsay talking about ugly vegetables.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
The ugly food movement, you know, I mean, it's...
Yes. Yeah, I forgot to bring you some ugly vegetables. I'm sorry. There weren't any on hand.
Explain this to people, because we're not talking about rotten fruit and rotten vegetables.
No, so there's a particular aesthetic for fruits and vegetables that we see in the marketplace. And so if your carrot has, you know, an extra limb, or if your apple, you know, has a twin that never separated from it, or yes, I know, or if your lemon is sort of pronged, those things are not deemed desirable in the marketplace. And so they are diverted in a number of different ways, but mostly to the landfill. And so as part of the food waste conversation, people are talking about ugly fruit and veg. And a major grocery chain, Giant Eagle, has just said they're going to have sort of a dysfunctional fruit section of their grocery store, where you can buy these less "quote unquote" attractive fruits at a reduced price. You can follow Ugly Fruit and Veg on Twitter and just see pictures of ugly fruits and vegetables. You can also tap into, quite literally, beer that has been made from food waste and ugly fruits and vegetables and breads that have been diverted. I know that Sam Caglione has worked with a celebrity chef to bring a food waste beer to market recently. So there's lots of places that these things are going, but there's no reason for them not to be on our plates.
That all sounds like food science, Paul, but it relates to geography anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah, we just need more people to start mapping all these ugly food sites all around North America. So it could be the new food tourism. We just sort of go and see the local ugly fruit.
We're talking with Paul Jackson and Lindsay Naylor from the University of Delaware's Geography Department. So you can hear that geography is really about, if you will, using maps or GIS systems like those that our student Nate works on as a lens through which you can see human activity.
And I think one of the biggest questions I like to think, to get my students to think about what geography is, we don't ask, where is Kansas? But we sort of ask, why is Kansas? The question is, like, why is Kansas different than Iowa? What made it its specific place? And so that's something I try to sort of change how they think about what geography does and how it answers questions in our world.
I'm originally from the Midwest, so I want to hear the answer to that. Why Kansas? Well, I have yet to find a reason.
My other thing is I try to get them to think, where does the Midwest end? Mm. Like, where's the border? Because is it the bottom of Ohio? Because that's Appalachia. Like, what's the difference between Appalachia and the Midwest?
So I think it's Pittsburgh.
You think it's Pittsburgh?
Because people in Pittsburgh drive courteously. They're not like East Coast drivers. You know, they really have those Midwest driving characteristics.
Yeah, and you could maybe how chatty people are in the checkout lines at grocery stores. That's maybe a border of the Midwest as well. So.
Well, we're joking about the kinds of behavior and things that, and then mapping them and trying to figure out geographical relationships there. But I think one of the things you guys told me about was, I didn't realize this, that saccharin comes from coal tar.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I've been reading a lot about soda with my students over the past couple of weeks. And when the sugar supply became less reliable, some soda companies sought sweetener replacements, and then in other cases wanted just non-sugar sweetener for diet purposes as well. And yeah, Monsanto was one of the first producers of non-sugar sweetener, and it was saccharin derived from coal tar.
And I think part of like why that's interesting to geographers is that similarly that we look at like a place on the map, we look at like the material that sort of makes up our world and where does that come from. Mm-hmm. So like in the studio, like where is the metal that makes up this microphone? And that is part of a commodity chain that may be from Uganda or from China. And so what is the geography of all the things that we take for granted in our everyday life? That's another form of questioning that we do.
I'm interested to hear you tell us the story of how you geographers have noted the different spending patterns by the government in responding to the two biggest hurricane disasters to have hit the eastern United States in a long time. Katrina, which hit.
in New Orleans.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes.
And other parts of Louisiana.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Sandy, yeah. Which hit?
New Jersey, New York, and Delaware. So I use this example because I think students have a memory of Hurricane Sandy. And some of them, I found University of Delaware students actually went down to New Orleans and helped out in the reconstruction there. Part of what geographers look at is how not everything is even across the landscape, even sort of disaster response. So what were some of the conditions to this sort of environmental weather system, and how did that affect different places differently? And so, New Orleans was affected quite more, but it's partly because of man-made reasons, like the levees not being maintained and upheld since the Army Corps of Engineers built it. And so that is a specific particularity that affected New Orleans, and there were different issues that affected the East Coast and New Jersey and the Jersey Shore. And stuff.
I, of course, am also suspicious that there were, you know, a different class of clients affected by the storm.
Absolutely. And the response, so the lead up and response to the storm is very much a function of that unevenness, especially economic unevenness, and really some of the racial discrimination that we have in the United States. So I was in New Orleans even just a couple of years ago, and there is still evidence of the hurricane and really this disaster in communities. A lot of the emphasis has been put on reviving the tourist industry and making sure that people can go and hang out and have, you know, what they expect in New Orleans, beignets and maybe bourbon on Bourbon Street. I don't know.
Similarly, in New Jersey, the emphasis has been rebuilding the shore tourism.
Right.
And this gets, to relate this back to Earth Day, this gets into a question that was coming around for the racial differences within the environmental movement in the 90s around questions of justice and environmental justice.
Yeah.
And this is a growing field within the environmental movement to bring these questions. And even not just in the United States, but on the global scale. And people are talking not just about climate change, but about climate justice, that it won't affect everyone equally. And we can see that in some of the low-lying islands, that they were going to be hit first. So the environment affects us all, but it doesn't affect us all evenly.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that geographers are helping regular Americans like me understand.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, sure, yes. I think the most important thing that we're doing is helping folks raise questions because this is not normal, this is not natural, and it should not be expected. And so I hope that some of the work that geographers are doing is helping to put a question mark at the end of folks' sentences. Like, why is this happening in this place differently? Like, why is it that an entire nation of people is going to be underwater? And, you know, what does that mean for, you know, Europe? Or what does that mean for Australia? Or what does that mean for the United States? What if Florida disappears? You know, who is that going to displace? What does that look like? And sort of these kinds of questions instead of, you know, is climate change real?
And I think the other side of that is also, I think a lot of people know a lot of these things instinctively, but what geographers can do is things like ArcGIS. It's a skill set, or climate modeling is another skill set. Urban planning is another skill set that we talk through to empower people to like take on these problems themselves, because we just have questions in our own research, but it should be something that anyone can use. And things like crowdsourcing mapping tools isn't a way that people can participate on their phones and on an app.
We didn't even get to 2/3 of the things on our list of things to talk about. We'll have to have you guys back again on Campus Voices. Lindsay Naylor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Paul Jackson, thank you.
Thanks.
I remember who you are.
It's been great. It's been great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Remember Earth Day.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at wvud.org.